Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by the Coriel Institute for Medical Research.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Jonathan Singer's introduction to medicine in Mexico was an injection in his behind.
It was a syringe full of something that looked like and felt like tomato juice.
Here's what happened. He was in college doing some work abroad, and he was seriously dehydrated after doing farm work. And the Mexican doctor said he needed an injection of vitamins.
It literally felt like it was thick tomato juice going into my butt. One of the most painful things I've ever felt in my life.
But it did cure him.
Within a matter of hours, I went from feeling like I was dead to feeling like I was on top of the world.
When you become a patient in another country, you notice differences in treatment, in how things are done. Neil Gussman had an accident in Germany and dislocated his finger, and his doctor didn't even use anesthesia.
He said, "This is going to hurt." And snap, it hurt.
Medicine and healthcare are shaped by the resources that are available, by politics and culture.
For an Indian hospital, it's not unusual for patients to bring their entire extended family along.
So it's common to see lots of people sleeping in the hallways outside of patient rooms.
It's easy if you want to skip out and work in Malaysia. You go to the clinic, you act like you're sick, and a doctor will give you a medical slip. Just pay him.
In Chile, we have a month and a half of prenatal maternity leave, full paid.
And then 6 months of paid maternity leave on top of that.
When you get older in Israel, you're entitled to a home health aid paid for by the government.
One of the big differences I found as a Brit living in America is how convoluted the payment systems are in the United States.
On this episode of The Pulse, different country, different medicine.
Medicina. Doa. Die
Medizin. Medizin.
La Medizin.
Yao.
Let's get started with Pulse reporter Alan Yu. He's from Hong Kong, and a lot of people there swear by acupuncture to find relief from all kinds of different ailments. Alan never bought into this. He's always relied on Western medicine, which is readily available, but he did want to find out why acupuncture remains so popular. So he recently took a trip home to look into this.
The train to Tsinghua, Kowloon, and Hong Kong is arriving.
For a lot of people in Hong Kong, acupuncture is medicine, and I wanted to meet some of the people who are believers.
I've been to Hong Kong
once.
Here is one of them, Gordon Liu. I met him just after work at a Chinese medicine clinic. He's been coming here for a couple of years. He works in an office all day, and his neck and joints often hurt. At first it was just a bit of pain, but about a year ago, it got serious. If he sounds funny, that's because he's already face down on the bed getting ready for acupuncture. He had a serious pain problem where he couldn't turn his neck. He got worried and went to the emergency room. The doctors ordered an X-ray and an MRI, but they didn't find anything wrong. He stayed overnight and got painkillers, but nothing worked. Gordon says what did work was acupuncture. It's the one thing that makes him feel better. Here he is speaking through a translator.
I think a lot of people in Hong Kong feel the same way. If we go to Western medicine doctors, you're just getting pain medication. You can buy that on your own. If you take the painkillers and it doesn't work, then you still need a solution, don't you? So we go to Chinese medicine practitioners, acupuncture, massages, to see if those work.
Today, Gordon's neck and shoulders hurt, and his joints also feel a little numb. His acupuncturist comes out.
Okay.
There's one step even before the first needle goes in. She has a cart and a lighter, like the kind you click to ignite a gas stove in your kitchen. The first thing she does is something called cupping. She turns on the lighter inside a couple of small glass cups. to burn away the oxygen and puts them on different spots on Gordon's back. That creates a bit of suction, then she pulls the cups out, leaving patches the size of golf balls. Some of the spots are blood red, others are darker, and she says that reflects the areas that need attention. The acupuncturist wipes down all the spots with cotton balls soaked in alcohol, then opens individually wrapped needles and puts them in. She attaches small crocodile clips to some of the needles, and that sends out a small electric current. You can see Gordon's hands tingling from the electricity. After 20 minutes, she takes the needles out and discards them.
My left side is still a little tight, around the shoulder. It still feels a little... Now it feels like my neck and shoulders are more movable, like they've loosened up.
This costs about $50. Gordon pays with a credit card, but he says his insurance will cover two-thirds of it. If he had gone to a Western medicine doctor for a consult and pills, his insurance would probably have covered the whole thing. He's an actuary, so he understands insurance. He speculates the pay difference is because insurance companies are more familiar with the scientific evidence behind Western medicine. But he doesn't care as much.
Don't think about how it works, or statistical costs. Think about how it benefits patients. This is an observable benefit, so I think it's worth trying.
But that doesn't answer my question, how does this work? Practitioners say the needles interact with specific points in our body to regulate the flow of life energy, or qi, which you might have heard of as qi. In this way of thinking, problems like pain happen because of blockages. In a healthy person, the qi is constantly flowing, like a river. For a person in pain, the qi is blocked, like if there's a big rock holding the river back. But of course, we can't see this qi energy like we can see blood vessels or nerves. The theory is that the needle unblocks it and restores the natural flow of things. To meet another believer, I caught a minibus all the way across Hong Kong Island to the south side. Three noodle shops, a Circle K, small dim sum place. I'm here to meet Claudia Gabison. She grew up in Hong Kong. Her father is French, her mother is Chinese. She's 20 and studies engineering at Northwestern University. Claudia has access to all kinds of Western medicine in Hong Kong and in the US. But she says acupuncture is the only thing that helps with her severe migraines. So she gets treatments whenever she's home for breaks. She's had these migraines since high school.
And so in class, I would always have a trash can next to me just in case I would puke. And I was always super sensitive to light and sound. Even a pencil dropping was so painful for me. Yeah, so a lot of pain. And I went to see a neurologist and I got an MRI scan with contrast and they couldn't find anything. So we ruled that out. And he just said it's stress. And I just had to take a lot of like Tylenol and ibuprofen and it was just not very healthy.
For a while, she was taking the maximum dose of Advil sinus pain, 8 pills in 24 hours.
I couldn't live without it. I couldn't like go to class or do any of my work without taking those pills, and it's like extremely strong.
She didn't want to keep doing that because of the potential side effects, which brings her to acupuncture.
It works.
I talked to quite a few people who get acupuncture for various ailments, and they all tell me that Western medicine and Chinese medicine are just good at treating different things. And I even hear this from physicians in Hong Kong who practice Western medicine, like Chi Wai Zheng, who is an anesthesiologist at Queen Mary, a large public hospital in Hong Kong. He's a pain specialist, but sometimes he does recommend acupuncture for some of his patients. I don't know, you don't have a study, but like roughly how many percent of the patients that you see have you referred to get acupuncture?
For difficult pain patients, 5%, 5 to 10%.
5 to 10%, okay.
Yeah, I want to refer more.
He says it especially works for some older patients who can't tolerate the dizziness or sleepiness from strong painkillers. When he makes a referral for acupuncture, he has to send his patients off-site. But now I want to take you to a place where Western medicine and Chinese medicine are in the same building. It's just across the border from Hong Kong, in the city of Shenzhen in mainland China. To get there, I jostle with tourists and their wheeled suitcases.
There's a bored-looking guard sitting at Chinese immigration.
Finally, I arrive at the University of Hong Kong Shenzhen Hospital. It's a huge medical complex with glass windows in various buildings as large as a small college. There I meet Li Xing Lau. He's a director of the School of Chinese Medicine.
I hope all the hospital in the conventional medical hospital have the division or department of Chinese medicine or acupuncture.
So in the US, you would call that integrative medicine. And Li Xing Lau would love to implement that here on a large scale.
So this the left side is for the emergency room. On the right side, we have Chinese medicine. So sometimes we work with emergency room patients as well. So sometimes acute back pain, or something, we provide service to them as well.
And to these patients, acupuncture is just another medical procedure they can get, like a blood test or physical therapy. Li Xing Lau is giving acupuncture to a businessman who came in with skin problems. Acupuncture has become so routine for this guy that he keeps talking to an associate on his cell phone.
I'm getting acupuncture done right now. I have to go back later. Okay, good.
Li Xing Lau does not approve.
You should really turn the phone off. It's not good for treatment.
Okay, I'll turn it off.
Yes, turn it off.
Li Xing Lau says you're supposed to be relaxed during acupuncture, not thinking about sales. So to recap, we don't really know how acupuncture works. I've spent 2 weeks in Hong Kong looking at acupuncture. People have told me it took their pain away. I'm still not convinced, but I've also never tried it myself. One acupuncturist said that means I'll never truly understand it unless I try it. He says the qi, or life energy, I can't see it, but he can show me what it feels like. He puts a needle in an acupoint about two-thirds of the way up my right forearm. It's not painful, and I entertain myself by clenching and unclenching my fist to see the needle wiggle. He can see I'm not impressed, so he offers to try a point that will give me a stronger sensation.
Okay. Alright, sure, you can see it. Oh, actually,
he's laughing because I told him he may as well throw everything at me because I'll never do this again. He places a second needle in the gap between my thumb and index finger. He's right, I can feel this needle more than the other one. I still didn't leave convinced. But in Hong Kong, it's good enough for insurance companies and the health department. Back in the US, acupuncture is not well covered. Skeptic Stephen Novella says it's appropriate that it's not more widespread here.
You're just adding this extra layer of waste into the system, and you are distracting people away from other strategies that might be effective.
He's a neurologist at Yale University and senior editor of the blog Science-Based Medicine. There are lots of other skeptics like him in the US, and that might be why acupuncture hasn't caught on with Medicare on a federal level. He says patients might say they feel better because of a placebo effect, but their symptoms do not objectively improve. He adds that clinical trials have not been able to prove that acupuncture changes anything other than how the patient feels about their pain.
Providing nothing real except, you know, smoke and mirrors.
And he's worried that if we open the door to acupuncture, then we might open the door to more treatments that we can't back with evidence.
This is the thin end of the wedge, where they're using placebo effects in order to continuously expand their claims.
But where does that leave doctors who are trying to meet the needs of patients who are in pain? ER physician Connor Laval says he needs more tools. Sometimes he has to use extremely strong painkillers, like opioids. Patients can become dependent after 2 months, and then they're back in this office asking for more.
It was a frustrating thing to have people come in and ask for refills on medications when I didn't think it was really appropriate to refill them. So I was interested in, you know, alternatives to that, and I was just kind of frustrated. And out of that frustration came an interest in what alternative possibilities there might be.
Connor looked at the research, even tried acupuncture himself.
I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where it's as widely accepted as other things that we can see tangibly and understand tangibly from a scientific perspective, like how a pharmaceutical drug works.
So he wouldn't go as far as to recommend acupuncture to his patients, but...
They come in asking, do you think that's silly, or do you think that I'm crazy doing that, or should I try another medication instead? And for those people, I've been saying, no, I think it's reasonable. If you find it effective and it's not breaking the bank for you...
Then he says, by all means, do it. Personally, I'm sticking to painkillers. For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
And here's a postscript to Alan's story. When we say traditional Chinese medicine, what are we actually talking about? If I had to define it, I would probably say it's a vast knowledge base, ancient approach to healing that was developed in China over the course of a few thousand years and passed on from generation to generation. But that's not entirely true, says Paul Unschuld.
The definition of Chinese medicine has changed several times over time.
Paul is a medical historian at Charité Medical University in Berlin.
Because the term traditional Chinese medicine came up only in the 1950s, when French visitors came to see what the Chinese did with their historical medicine in a new communist society.
In Mao's New People's Republic of China, everything was changing. Everything was under scrutiny, including how medicine and healing had been approached.
And many modern trained physicians said, excuse us, this is just the garbage, and I repeat this literally, of the past. And Marxist thinkers, they agreed and said, let's forget all this. The future of China and its future strength must be based on modern technology, on modern science, and of course also on modern medicine. So they set up a committee, and this committee selected from the literature and from, you know, folk medicine, etc., those elements which they thought should survive in a modern, socialist, science-dominated society of a future China regaining its strength and international image. And this they called traditional Chinese medicine. And it is just a very, very small digest from that vast and heterogeneous historical heritage.
How did they pick what to keep and what to toss? And how were they qualified to make those decisions?
That's a very good question. Because, I mean, this issue hasn't settled to this day, because the committee was mostly set up of modern Western trained physicians. And of course, these people knew very little of traditional Chinese medicine. And it's still not clear what criteria they used in order to pick out what they believed should survive in a modern socialist and science-oriented society.
They did include a big portion of the ancient pharmaceuticals, Chinese herbs. They also kept some aspects of acupuncture, but a lot was left out. And that means the thing we call traditional Chinese medicine now is something that was really designed less than a century ago. Paul Unschuld is a medical historian, and his book is Traditional Chinese Medicine, Heritage and Adaptation. I travel to Germany a lot to visit my family, and in recent years, I've heard people there talk about a syndrome they call der Burnout. Yes, they do use an English word, but they pronounce it in a sort of German way. And to me, it sounded like work stress, anxiety, lack of sleep, but it seems to go beyond that. It seemed like culturally they had repackaged this into a brand new condition that was spreading like wildfire. So what exactly is diagnosis burnout, and how is it treated? Sarah Hoshiari reports from Berlin.
Fritzi Gärtner is 40 and lives in Pankow, a neighborhood in the north of Berlin. When she was in her late 20s, she was studying to become a teacher, working full-time. She was a single mom with two little kids. But she found herself unable to do seemingly simple things.
I wasn't able to go grocery shopping anymore. I couldn't decide, and then I started to cry and had to leave the store. And I knew I could no longer go shopping. I can't do it.
She was also getting sick all the time.
I was getting viruses all the time, just different illnesses. And where it took other people 2 weeks to get better, it took me 5.
Fritzi thought maybe she should go to the gym more often to get back into shape, to become fit and healthy again. But it didn't work.
I didn't sleep at all at night. Sick, 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 sick.
I asked Fritzi if she suspected back then that the way she was feeling was connected to stress.
I never would have suspected that any of this was related to stress.
But soon, all of Germany would start talking about a condition called burnout.
Es geht ein Gespenst an deutschen Unis, das immer mehr von uns Besitz ergreift. Burnout.
Immer mehr und immer jüngere Menschen sind von Burnout betroffen.
Aus Ende. Burnout.
All of a sudden, we had burnout as a major headline in many journals and newspapers, and the TV shows were full of people who reported about their own experiences with burnout.
The symptoms? Total exhaustion, feeling sad, irritable, being unable to sleep or concentrate, and eventually not being able to work.
Many people, I think, were asking themselves if we are developing towards a burnout society.
This is Mazda Adli.
I'm a psychiatrist and psychotherapist, and I'm a stress researcher.
He directs mood disorders research at the Charité.
And the Charité is Berlin's well-known medical school and university. Stress can result in diseases if it becomes chronic.
Mazda says when stress is relentless and people feel trapped, it can result in burnout.
Continuous hierarchical conflicts at the working place, for example, or if you're in permanent struggle with a colleague.
But he says burnout is not an independent disorder.
About 85% of those who come with the label burnout show clear signs of a depressive episode, and the other 15% are basically a mixture of anxiety disorders, adaptation problems, and other mental diseases.
So burnout is an additional label tied to depression or anxiety to specify that work-related stress is at the root of the person's problems. And Adli says the more people talked about burnout, the more people got diagnosed with it.
We saw a continuous increase of patients labeled with burnout by their doctors because there was this increasing public awareness, but there was also for many people this synonym to depression, and it was easier for many people to talk about burnout than talk about depression, even if they suffered from depression very clearly.
Adli says among mental health professionals there was a fear that burnout could become a positive synonym for depression, a depression for hardworking people, so to speak. And that might result in the disease being stigmatized even further.
At the end of the day, there could be a good depression called burnout and a bad depression called depression.
Adli says it took a lot of conversation and outreach to spread solid information about burnout. In recent years, the diagnosis of burnout has dropped off. If you do get diagnosed with it, treatment might sound like a fantasy for Americans. Several weeks of paid sick leave, therapy covered by insurance.
Ich weiß, dass in dieser psychosomatischen Klinik, in der ich war, da gab es eine extra Gruppe für Lehrer.
Fritzi Gärtner did inpatient treatment at a psychiatric clinic for 6 weeks. And then she started working again.
Wovor? Also ich auf jeden Fall die meiste Angst hatte, ob ich
That was my biggest fear. Would I be able to get back to work?
Germany has a model in place, specifically designed for teachers with burnout, to slowly get back into working.
For 3 months in the beginning, only 3 days a week, 4 hours a day. And then slowly, it's increasing so that you carefully re-enter your job.
Fritzi says ultimately, the burnout changed her life, but not in a negative way.
I've had such a happy life since then. Really. Ultimately, it was a gift.
For The Pulse, I'm Sara Hushyori in Berlin.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. How we understand and treat different conditions often depends on culture and politics. Now, let's head to Mexico for a bit of a history lesson on how that country deals with birth control. Over five decades, the approach has changed dramatically, with big effects. Here's Joy Diaz with this story.
Let's start 50 years ago when the United Nations declared family planning as a human right.
Mexico emitió su voto favorable con profunda convicción.
Mexico's UN representative, Antonio Martínez Báez, said that his country voted in favor of the resolution, and not only in favor, but with deep conviction in the hopes that women could achieve full equality under the law and in every facet of life. Mexico took that UN resolution to heart.
Yes. My grandmother had 13 children, and my mother had four, and I don't have any.
13 children? Four kids? None. Gabriela Rivera is an OBGYN in Mexico City. She's also with the United Nations Population Office in Mexico. The story of the women in her family is like a mirror image of the country, where the birth rate has dropped dramatically. Let's look at birth rates in the 1960s. While women in developed nations like the U.S. were on average giving birth to four kids, the average woman in Mexico was giving birth to seven. Today, UN data puts the average woman in the U.S. and in Mexico virtually tied, giving birth to about two kids. In addition to that 1968 UN resolution, in 1974, Mexico amended its constitution to give people the right to decide when and if they want children and how many they want.
Article 4 of the constitution, the Mexican constitution, has been changed.
The new law worked to counter cultural forces that had led to large families with lots of kids. One major influence being the Catholic Church. The church's message was basically, get married and have as many children as the Lord gives you. The constitutional amendment gave Mexicans the right to decide on family size. Next, the country created an Office of Population. Its mission was to manage population growth to ultimately improve the country's economic development.
Al inicio de nuestra era, en el planeta habitaban 200 millones de personas.
The office launched a multimedia campaign, and in one commercial from the 1970s, celebrities talked about how overpopulation led to fewer resources for all.
Crecer no significa ser muchos, sino mejores.
The message was clear. Birth control was key to a better life. But since Mexico has the highest percentage of Catholics in Latin America, for the pro-birth control message to take hold, the government needed to make birth control not only legal, but easy to get.
Access to family planning is for free. Even if they have no health insurance, they can get it for free.
Vasectomies are free. Condoms are free. The pill is free. IUDs are free. So, the birth rate in Mexico dropped, and the economy did improve. 47% of households in Mexico are now considered middle class. Access to free birth control has also reduced mommy and baby deaths. Today, the maternal mortality rate in Mexico is on the decline. But along the way, politics changed, and so did birth control.
Hoy estoy aquí porque creo. In Mexico.
That's Vicente Fox. He became Mexico's 55th president in 2000. And before him, presidents in Mexico had never spoken openly about their faith. Fox, on the other hand, let everyone know he was a devout Catholic. Reproductive health researcher Manuel Santoyo from the National Autonomous University in Mexico says the Fox administration and the one right after adhered to the Catholic belief that most birth control methods are sinful.
What I can say about those administrations is that they're extremely to the right, extremely conservative, and they stopped educating people about their sexual and reproductive rights. They stopped educating people about ways to prevent pregnancies.
Now, teen pregnancies in Mexico are on the rise. And to combat that, once again, the government turned to an education campaign using the media. President Enrique Peña Nieto's administration released a new series of commercials targeted at teens with euphemistic slogans such as, if you're headed to the party, bring some balloons. Condoms and other forms of contraceptives are now widely available not only in health clinics, but also in schools and even at food banks. There's a new leader in Mexico, and healthcare watchers and reproductive rights advocates are wondering what President-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador will do next. For The Pulse, I'm Joy Diaz.
Joy first reported the story for the Texas Standard.
Supporting The Pulse, the Coriel Institute for Medical Research, enabling scientific discovery around the world through its renowned collections of cell lines and DNA from the National Institute on Aging and National Institute for General Medical Sciences. Learn more at coriel.org.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're looking at medicine and healthcare in different countries, how politics and culture impact treatment. The civil war in Syria has been raging for more than 7 years, killing about 400,000 people. Millions have fled the country, among them half of Syria's doctors. The physicians who are still there face big obstacles in getting patients the care they need. Reporter Pat Hilsman traveled to Qamishlo, that's a city in Syria's predominantly Kurdish northeast, and he met up with two doctors there.
Turkey destroyed these quarters.
That's Abdul Salam, my translator. We are driving along a dusty city road in Qamishlo. It's in Syria, right across the Turkish border. He's pointing at buildings on the Turkish side that were destroyed during recent fighting.
Right there. Right. Jesus.
Ahead is an Assad regime checkpoint. We both get nervous as we approach. Encounters between local citizens, Kurdish-led militia, and regime forces can erupt into violence, like the shootout that killed at least 11 pro-regime fighters on September 8th, about 6 weeks after this was recorded.
I'm going to put my camera down in 3, 2, 1.
I'm here to meet with doctors who are still seeing patients, Syrians living here. They don't want to use their full names because they are scared of the Assad regime. Many of their patients are wanted by the regime for military service.
I study in Aleppo University.
That's Ahmad. He's an endocrinologist. We meet in an office near his clinic. He decided to become a doctor at a young age.
I saw my mother suffer from diabetes and cardiac disease.
And is that why specifically you became an endocrinologist?
Yes, for my mother.
I also meet Saka. He is a pediatrician.
Abdul Salam translates.
It was my aim because I love children and I want to help them.
The war has been going on for over 7 years, but both men remember what it was like to practice medicine before it started.
Before the war, I were in Damascus. About 95% of drugs are available. But when the war began, I came to Qamishli. About 75% of drugs are not available because of border. Closed.
Soccer says the prices for drugs that are still available have skyrocketed.
So all things after the war becomes 10 times expensive because everything's brought, imported. So everything becomes more expensive 10 times.
The two doctors are forced to improvise. For example, with diabetic patients who require constant treatment, Ahmed swaps and substitutes medicines depending on what he can get his hands on at any given time.
If I don't have metformin, I can use bioglitazone and sitagliptin. And if I don't have rapid insulin and glargine or lantose, I can use mixed insulin.
For many of Soccer's sick patients, being able to get treatment or not depends on finances. For some, it's the difference between life and death. Other barriers are political. Young fathers fear conscription in an ongoing war that has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. Ahmad recently tried to help a family facing a terrible decision.
A child, 6 months old, they were from Kobani. She had, or her body becomes blue because she had birth defect, like heart diseases, cyanosis, make the patients blue. Her father was young. He was afraid to go to Damascus because we said, you are obliged to take her to Damascus. But because he was afraid from taking him to the military service by the regime, he said, I can't. Her parents decided to take her home and to face the death. And after days, she dead. She was dead.
If the father had been caught, he could have been forced to serve in the war or arrested. The child still likely would have died because the family would have lost its income. Being a doctor here can feel desperate and powerless.
We trapped.
But still, Ahmed does what he can with the available resources. And sometimes all he has to give is kindness.
When patients come to my clinic and when I examine them, I smile with them. That's very good to smile with your patient.
For The Pulse, I'm Patrick Hilsman.
Over the past 5 years, nearly 5,000 wounded Syrians have received medical treatment in Israel. The two countries have technically been in a state of war for decades. They have no diplomatic relations. But a few years ago, Israel launched a program called Operation Good Neighbor to treat Syrians wounded in the civil war. Israel recently pulled the plug on the program, but reporter Kyle Mackey was able to catch up with one of the last Syrian patients remaining in Israel at Ziv Medical Center. Kyle, tell me about the young patient you met and spoke with.
I met a 14-year-old boy named Ahmad and his mother, who is also staying with him at Ziv Medical Center in northern Israel, where he is receiving treatment. And Ahmad was injured in a Syrian army airstrike this past spring.
I can tell you the story. I go out of my home to the market, and then I just hear a bomb, and I look at myself, and I see that one of my legs was on the floor. I remember people start running to my side, and somebody picked me up, and they took me to the small clinic in the village. They told me that I have to wait until 9 o'clock at night because they want to get permission from the Israeli army so that they can take care of me in Israeli hospitals.
What kind of state was Ahmad in when he arrived at the Israeli hospital?
Ahmad was severely injured and he suffered what the doctors call an incomplete amputation. He lost a severe amount of soft tissue in his leg, but his foot was still attached. So he's been undergoing a limb salvage treatment that is saving his leg.
So I would imagine that doctors in Israel know how to deal with these injuries because Israel has been through a lot of wars and has also had a lot of experiences with terror, with these kinds of injuries.
Yes, absolutely. Many of the doctors have spent a good part of their career treating Israeli soldiers and victims of terror attacks, but these injuries did still require innovative new treatments. And I'm going to let one of the doctors tell you more about that himself. This is Dr. Michael Harari, who is a senior pediatrician at Ziv, and he's been in charge of coordinating Ahmad's care.
Many children arrive here ostensibly needing amputation, and the orthopedic surgeons have been quite almost dogmatic that they will not amputate a child's limb. If there's even the faintest chance of the limb being salvaged, so they have a philosophy which is to not straighten a limb if it's threatened with amputation, but leave it crooked. They do the microsurgery on vessels and on nerves. They then, over time, then gradually straighten it.
Kyle, I'm wondering if you can explain that a little bit more. What does he mean, not straightening the limb?
From what I understand, leaving the limb crooked is a kind of staged treatment that's more common in military medicine than civilian medicine. It gives the soft tissue plenty of time it needs to heal. In most cases, not to be too graphic, but legs have been blown open. So first they need to close the tissue around the bone, and then they're able to straighten it out and lengthen the limb later. Because what often happens with these incomplete amputations is that the damaged limb becomes quite a bit shorter than the healthy limb.
So what is the future of Ahmad now that this program has ended? And also, how is his leg doing?
Well, his leg is doing well. I am told that he's starting to walk. But unfortunately, the future for Ahmad and the other few Syrian patients who are still in Israel is uncertain. The IDF spokesman declined to comment on that. But it is a different set of circumstances now that the border is closed. The Assad regime is in control of southern Syria once again. And Operation Good Neighbor, which was this massive humanitarian and medical assistance program by Israel, is now ended.
Kyle, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Kyle Mackey is a contributing reporter for the English edition of Haaretz, and she is in Tel Aviv. For our last story, we're going to go to India, to Bangalore, a city in the south. Sri Jayadeva is a big public hospital with 1,100 beds, and every part of this hospital is crowded at all times. Every seat is taken, people are sleeping in the hallways. So staff there decided to turn these crowds into a resource. Mary Rose Abram reports.
Cardiac patient Sidlapa, who goes by one name, is 58 years old, and he's waiting to get an angiogram.
He's in a very good mood for being in a hospital.
This happens to everyone. All of us are not going to be healthy all the time. As long as you live, you should be happy and enjoy life, and then move on.
In fact, along with the heart procedure, he kind of sees this as a chance to see Bangalore for the first time. Sidlapa's hometown is an eight-hour drive from the city. He's here with his wife and two of his seven children. For an Indian hospital, that's actually a pretty small entourage. It's not unusual for patients to bring their entire extended family along. 6 years ago, some American students from Stanford University noticed the overflow and saw not a problem, but a solution. What if those waiting family members could play a more active role in patients' care?
That's the first and foremost thing they observed in the Indian healthcare system. Like when they were visiting hospital, like there's just one patient, but there are like 10 relatives who is behind him.
That's Anand Kumar. He is a nurse who has worked with those students almost from the start. The students launched a plan to educate family members who often know little about what's going on with their loved one.
When you talk to them, okay, what happened to the patient, how he's doing, they're still, you know, unclear about the patient's situation. They don't even know like what procedure the patient gone through, how to take care of him back in the home.
Today, the Care Companion program turns waiting family into active healthcare helpers. It's run by a social nonprofit called Nura Health.
So, ellarigu namaskara. Ellare kannada baruttala?
Okay.
It's late afternoon visiting hours in the men's cardiology ward. Naveen Kumar gathers patients and their family members and turns the hallway into a classroom. There's an instructional video. Nurse Naveen alternates between playing the video and talking to the group.
When they go discharged, and when they got discharged, and when they go to the house, and it's the responsibility of the family members, like maybe wife or husband or son, daughter, to take care of the patients, so that it's our duty to train them.
Sidlapa, the heart patient we met earlier, doesn't read or write, but he seemed to learn a lot just by watching the presentation.
I have to eat less food and be careful about my diet. I should wash my hands before eating, and I should be very careful about the weight that I lift. And I should not lift anything that's very heavy. I also learned not to smoke, not to drink, not to chew tobacco and pan.
Neura Health says the program has collected data to show nearly a quarter less readmissions for cardiac patients and more than 70% reduction in complications after hospital discharge. Here's Nurse Anand Kumar again.
So if they are trained well, if they are empowered, definitely the outcome of patient care, you know, it improves a lot. Also, the moment that happens, automatically, again, it reduces the burden on the healthcare economy.
I spoke with a young mother, Jyotiyama Ulugeshia, through a translator.
They have conducted an operation and they're saying the baby's fine now. 2 days back, the baby developed some breathing difficulty, so they put a pipe. But now, the baby's okay.
Jyotiyama's son Ramesh is 8 months old. He has a heart defect. Their home is 270 miles away, and they want to stay close to the baby. So at night, Jyotiyama, her husband, and her uncle sleep on the floor outside his room. It's been nearly a month. Jyotiyama's not sure, but she thinks she's about 15 years old, though she looks to be closer to 18. She never went to school, but yesterday, she attended a family training session.
I learned not to hold the baby from the underarms because that would increase pressure on the wound, and to hold the baby by giving support to the head and the body. If the baby starts to crawl, you can allow the baby to do so, provided you make sure the floor is really clean.
These basic guidelines can be life-changing. Vasanta Kumari is the nurse supervisor for the pediatric recovery.
If we don't give any interaction, no interaction or any classes or any education for the parents, the prognosis of the surgery, the use of the surgery may not be happen. Patient may die because of improper care of the baby, improper feeding, improper hygiene.
That young mother, Jyotiyama, is hoping to bring her son Ramesh home soon.
I will be happy when I see my baby playing the way he did when he was younger. I just want him to get back to how he was.
Mary Rose Abram reported this story from Bangalore, India. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu and Liz Tung. Our engineers are Mike Villers and Charlie Kyer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.